Almost immediately Bertuccio entered the apartment. "Did your excellency desire to see me?" inquired he. "I did," replied the count. "You no doubt observed the horses standing a few minutes since at the door?" "Certainly, your excellency. I noticed them for their remarkable beauty." "Then how comes it," said Monte Cristo with a frown, "that when I desired you to purchase for me the finest pair of horses to be found in Paris, you permitted so splendid a couple as those I allude to be in the possession of anyone but myself?" At the look of displeasure, added to the angry tone in which the count spoke, Ali turned pale and held down his head. "It is not your fault, my good Ali," said the count in the Arabic language, and in a tone of such gentleness as none would have given him credit for being capable of showing. "It is not your fault. You do not profess to understand the choice of English horses." The countenance of poor Ali recovered its serenity. "Permit me to assure your excellency," said Bertuccio, "that the horses you speak of were not to be sold when I purchased yours." Monte Cristo shrugged his shoulders. "It seems, Monsieur L'Entendant," said he, "that you have yet to learn that all things are to be sold to such as care to pay the price. Monsieur Le Comte is not perhaps aware that Monsieur Danglars gave 16,000 francs for his horses?" "Very well, then offer him double that sum. A banker never loses an opportunity of doubling his capital." "Is your excellency really in earnest?" inquired the steward. Monte Cristo regarded the person who durst presume to doubt his words with the look of one equally surprised and displeased. "I have to pay a visit this evening," replied he. "I desire that these horses, with completely new harness, may be at the door with my carriage." Bertuccio bowed and was about to retire, but when he reached the door he paused and then said, "At what o'clock does your excellency wish the carriage and horses ready?" "At 5 o'clock," replied the count. "I beg your excellency's pardon," interposed the steward in a deprecating manner, "for venturing to observe that it is already 2 o'clock." "I am perfectly aware of that fact," answered Monte Cristo calmly. Then, turning towards Ali, he said, "Let all the horses in my stables be led before the windows of your young lady, that she may select those she prefers for her carriage. Request her also to oblige me by saying whether it is her pleasure to dine with me. If so, let dinner be served in her apartments." The count then motioned to Ali to follow him into his study, where they conversed long and earnestly together. As the hand of the clock pointed to 5 o'clock, the count struck thrice upon his gong. When Ali was wanted, one stroke was given, two summoned Battista, and three Bertuccio. The steward entered. "My horses," said Monte Cristo, "they are at the door, harnessed to the carriage as your excellency desired. Does Monsieur Le Comte wish me to accompany him?" "No. The coachman, Ali, and Battista will be sufficient without you." The count descended to the door of his mansion, and beheld his carriage drawn by the very pair of horses he had so much admired in the morning as the property of Danglars. As he passed them, he said, "They are extremely handsome, certainly, and you have done well to purchase them, although you were somewhat remiss not to have procured them sooner. Indeed, your excellency, I had very considerable difficulty in obtaining them, and, as it is, they have cost an enormous price." "Does the sum you gave for them make the animals less beautiful?" inquired the count, shrugging his shoulders. "Nay, if your excellency is satisfied, all is as I could wish it. Whither does Monsieur Le Comte desire to be driven?" "To the residence of Monsieur le Baron Danglars, Rue de la Chaussée d'Antin." This conversation had passed as they stood upon the terrace from which a flight of stone steps led to the carriage drive. As Bertuccio, with a respectful bow, was moving away, the count called him back. "I have another commission for you, Monsieur Bertuccio," said he. "I am desirous of having an estate by the seaside in Normandy, for instance, between Havre and Boulogne. You see, I give you a wide range. It will be absolutely necessary that the place you may select have a small harbour, creek, or bay, into which my vessel can enter and remain at anchor. She merely draws 15 feet water. She must be kept in constant readiness to sail immediately I think proper to give the signal. Make the requisite inquiries for a place of this description, and when you have met with an eligible spot, visit it, and if it possess the advantages desired, purchase it at once in your own name. The corvette must now, I think, be on her way to Fécamp, must she not? Certainly, Your Excellency. I saw her put to sea the same evening we quitted Marseille, and the yacht was ordered to remain at Martigues. 'Tis well. I wish you to write from time to time to the captains in charge of the two vessels, so as to keep them on the alert. And the steamboat. Has Your Excellency any orders to give respecting her? She is at Chalon, is she not? She is, my lord. The directions I gave you for the other two vessels may suffice for the steamboat also. I understand, my lord, and will punctually fulfil your commands. When you have purchased the estate I desire, I mean to establish constant relays of horses at 10 leagues distance, one from the other, along the northern and southern road. Your Excellency may fully depend upon my zeal and fidelity in all things. The Count gave an approving smile, descended the terrace steps, and sprang into his carriage, which, drawn by the beautiful animal so expensively purchased, was whirled along with incredible swiftness, and stopped only before the house of the banker. Danglars was engaged at that moment, presiding over a railway committee, but the meeting was nearly concluded when the name of his visitor was announced. As the Count's title sounded on his ear, he rose, and addressing his colleagues, many of whom were members of either chamber, he said, "Gentlemen, I must pray you to excuse my quitting you thus, but a most ridiculous circumstance has occurred, which is this. Thompson and French, the bankers at Rome, have sent to me a certain individual, calling himself the Count of Monte Cristo, who is desirous of opening an account with me to any amount he pleases. I confess this is the drollest thing I have ever met with in the course of my extensive foreign transactions, and you may readily suppose it has greatly roused my curiosity. Indeed, so much did I long to see the bearer of so unprecedented an order for an unlimited credit, that I took the trouble this morning to call on the pretended count, for his title is a mere fiction, of that I am persuaded. We all know counts nowadays are not famous for their riches. But would you believe, upon arriving at the residence of the soi-disant Count of Monte Cristo, I was very coolly informed he did not receive visitors that day. Upon my word, such airs are ridiculous, and befitting only some great millionaire or a capricious beauty. I made inquiries, and found that the house where the said Count resides in the Champs-Élysées is his own property, and certainly it was very decently kept up and arranged, as far as I could judge from the gardens and exterior of the house. But, pursued Danglars, with one of his sinister smiles, an order for unlimited credit calls for something like caution on the part of the banker on whom that order is given. These facts stated, I will freely confess, I am very anxious to see the individual just now announced. I suspect a hoax is intended, but the good folks who thought fit to play it off on me knew but little whom they had to deal with.
Having delivered himself of this pompous address, uttered with a degree of energy that left the Baron almost out of breath, he bowed to the assembled party and withdrew to his drawing-room, whose sumptuous fittings up of white and gold had caused a great and admiring sensation in the Chaussée d'Antin. It was to this apartment he had desired his guest to be shown, fully reckoning upon the overwhelming effect so dazzling a coup d'œil would produce. He found the Count standing before some copies of Albano and Fattore that had been passed off to the bankers as originals, but which, copies of the paintings of those great masters as they were, seemed to feel their degradation in being brought into juxtaposition with the gaudy gilding that covered the ceiling. The Count turned round as he heard the entrance of Danglars into the room. With a slight inclination of the head, Danglars signed to the Count to be seated, pointing significantly to a gilded armchair covered with white satin embroidered with gold. The Count obeyed. I have the honour, I presume, of addressing Monsieur de Monte Cristo. The Count bowed. And I of speaking to Baron Danglars, Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur and member of the Chamber of Deputies. With an air of extreme gravity, Monte Cristo slowly enumerated the various titles engraved on the card left at his house by the Baron. Danglars felt all the irony contained in the address of his visitor. For a minute or two, he compressed his lips as though seeking to conquer his rage ere he trusted himself to speak. Then, turning to his visitor, he said,
"You will, I trust, excuse my not having called you by your title when I first addressed you. But you are aware we are living under a popular form of government, and that I am myself a representative of the liberties of the people."
"So much so," replied Monte Cristo, "that while preserving the habit of styling yourself Baron, you have deemed it advisable to lay aside that of calling others by their titles."
"Upon my word," said Danglars, with affected carelessness, "I attach no sort of value to such empty distinctions. But the fact is, I was made Baron, and also Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur, in consequence of some services I had rendered government. But you have abdicated your titles after the example set you by Messrs. De Montmorency and Lafayette. Well, you cannot possibly choose more noble models for your conduct."
"Why," replied Danglars, "I do not mean to say I have altogether laid aside my titles. With the servants, for instance, there I think it right to preserve my rank with all its outward forms."
"I see. To your domestics you are my lord, monsieur le baron. The journalists of today style you monsieur, while your constituents term you citizen."
Again Danglars bit his lips with baffled spite. He saw well enough that he was no match for Monte Cristo in an argument of this sort, and he therefore hastened to turn to subjects more familiar to him, and calculated on having all the advantages on his side.
"Permit me to inform you, Monsieur le Comte," said he, bowing, "that I have received a letter of advice from Thompson and French of Rome.
I am glad to hear it, Monsieur le Baron, for I must claim the privilege of so addressing you as well as your servants. I have acquired the bad habit of calling persons by their style and title from living in a country where barons are still met with simply because persons are never suddenly elevated to a rank which is possessed only in right of ancestry. But as regards the letter of advice, I am charmed to find it has reached you. That will spare me the troublesome and disagreeable task of coming to you for money myself. You have received a regular letter of advice, therefore my checks will be duly honoured, and we shall neither of us have to go out of our way in the transaction."
"There is one slight difficulty," said Danglars, "and that consists in my precisely comprehending the letter itself."
"Indeed?
And for that reason, I did myself the honour of calling upon you, in order to beg you would explain some part of it to me."
"With much pleasure. Pray, now I am here, let me know what it was that baffled your powers of comprehension."
"Why," said Danglars, "in the letter, I believe I have it about me." Here he felt in his breast pocket. "Yes, here it is. Well, this letter gives Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo unlimited credit on our house."
"And what is there that requires explaining in that simple fact, may I ask, Monsieur le Baron?"
"Merely the term unlimited, and nothing else, certainly."
"Is not that word known in France?"
"Perhaps, indeed, it does not belong to the language, for the persons from whom you received your letter of advice are a species of Anglo-Germans, and very probably do not write very choice or accurate French."
"Oh, as for the composition of the letter, there is not the smallest error in it. But as regards the competency of the document, I certainly have doubts."
"Is it possible?" asked the Count,
assuming an air and tone of the utmost simplicity and candour. Is it possible that Thompson and French are not looked upon as safe and solvent bankers? Pray tell me what you think, Monsieur le Baron, for I feel uneasy, I can assure you, having some considerable property in their hands. Thompson and French are bankers of the highest repute, replied Danglars, with an almost mocking smile, and it was not of their solvency or capability I spoke, but of the word unlimited, which, in financial affairs, is so extremely vague a term that, in fact, said Monte Cristo, that its sense is also without limitation. Precisely what I was about to say, cried Danglars. Now, what is vague is doubtful, and, says the wise man, where there is doubt, there is danger. Meaning to say, rejoined Monte Cristo, that however Thompson and French may be inclined to commit acts of imprudence and folly, Monsieur le Baron Danglars is not disposed to follow their example.
How so, Monsieur le Comte?
Simply thus. The banking house of Thompson and French set no bounds to their engagements, while that of Monsieur Danglars has its limits. Truly, he is wise as the sage whose prudent apothegm he quoted but just now.
Monsieur, replied the banker, drawing himself up with a haughty air, the amount of my capital, or the extent and solvency of my engagements, have never yet been questioned.
It seems, then, reserved for me, said Monte Cristo coldly, to be the first to do so.
And by what right, sir?
By right of the objections you have raised, and the explanations you have demanded, which certainly imply considerable distrust on your part, either of yourself or me, the former, most probably.
Well, sir, resumed Danglars, after a brief silence, I will endeavour to make myself understood by requesting you to inform me for what sum you propose to draw upon me.
Why, truly, replied Monte Cristo, determined not to lose an inch of the ground he had gained. My reason for desiring an unlimited credit was precisely because I did not know what money I might expend. The banker now thought it his turn to show off and make a display of wealth and consequence. Flinging himself back, therefore, in his armchair, he said with an arrogant and purse-proud air,
"Let me beg of you not to hesitate in naming your wishes. You will then be convinced that the resources of the House of Danglars, however limited, are still equal to meeting the largest demands. And were you even to require 1,000,000, I beg your pardon?" interposed Monte Cristo.
"I observed," replied Danglars with a patronizing and pompous air, "that should you be hard pressed, the concern of which I am the head would not scruple to accommodate you to the amount of 1,000,000.
1,000,000? Retorted the Count.
"And what use can you possibly suppose so pitiful a sum would be to me? My dear sir, if a trifle like that could suffice me, I should never have given myself the trouble of opening an account for so contemptible an amount.
1,000,000!
Excuse my smiling when you speak of a sum I am in the habit of carrying in my pocket-book or dressing-case." And with these words, Monte Cristo took from his pocket a small case containing his visiting cards and drew forth 2 orders on the treasury for 500,000 francs each, payable at sight to the bearer. A man like Danglars was wholly inaccessible to any gentler method of correction. His upstart arrogance, his ostentatious vulgarity, were only assailable by blows dealt with the force and vigour of the present coup. Its effect on the banker was perfectly stunning, and, as though scarcely venturing to credit his senses, he continued gazing from the paper to the Count with a confused and mystified air.
"Come, come," said Monte Cristo, "confess honestly that you have not perfect confidence in the responsibility of the House of Thompson and French. There is nothing very strange in your exercising what seems to you a necessary caution. However, foreseeing that such might be the case, I determined, spite of my ignorance in such matters, to be provided with the means of banishing all scruples from your mind, and at the same time leaving you quite at liberty to act as you pleased in the affair. See, here are 2 similar letters to that you have yourself received, the one from the house of Arstein and Eskelers of Vienna,
to Baron de Rothschild, the other drawn from Baring of London to Monsieur Lafitte. Now, sir, you have but to say the word, and I will spare you all uneasiness and alarm on the subject by presenting my letter of credit at one or other of the establishments I have named." The blow had struck home, and Danglars was entirely vanquished. With a trembling hand he took the two letters from Vienna and London from the Count, who held them carelessly between his finger and thumb, as though to him they were mere everyday matters to which he attached but very little interest. Having carefully perused the documents in question, the banker proceeded to ascertain the genuineness of the signatures, and this he did with a scrutiny so severe as might have appeared insulting to the Count had it not suited his present purpose to mislead the banker in every respect.
"Well, sir," said Danglars, rising after he had well convinced himself of the authenticity of the documents he held, and bowing as though in adoration of a man, the thrice happy possessor of as many orders for unlimited credit on the three principal banks of Paris, "you have there signatures worth untold wealth. Although your conversation and vouchers put an end to all mistrust in the affair, you must pardon me, Monsieur le Comte, for confessing the most extreme astonishment."
"Nay, nay," answered Monte Cristo, with the easiest and most gentlemanly air imaginable. "'Tis not for such trifling sums as these to startle or astonish the banking house of Monsieur le Baron Danglars. Then, as all is settled as to forms between us, I will thank you to send a supply of money to me tomorrow. By all means, Monsieur le Comte. What sum do you want?"
"Why," replied Monte Cristo, "since we mutually understand each other, we may as well fix a sum as the probable expenditure of the first year. Suppose we say 6 millions to—"
"6 millions?" gasped out Danglars.
Certainly, whatever you please."
"Then, if I should require more," continued Monte Cristo, in a careless and indifferent manner, "why, of course, I should draw upon you. But my present intention is not to remain in France more than a year, and during that period I scarcely think I shall exceed the sum I mentioned. However, we shall see.
The money you desire shall be at your house by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, Monsieur le Comte," replied Danglars. "How would you like to have it? In gold, silver, or notes?"
"Half in gold and the other half in banknotes, if you please," said the Count, rising from his seat.
"I must confess to you, Monsieur le Comte," said Danglars, "that I have hitherto imagined myself acquainted with the degree of fortune possessed by all the rich individuals of Europe. And still, wealth such as yours has been wholly unknown to me. May I presume to ask whether you have long possessed it?"
"It has been in the family a very long while," returned Monte Cristo, "a sort of treasure, expressly forbidden to be touched for a certain period of years, during which the accumulated interest has doubled the capital. The period appointed by the testator for the disposal of these riches occurred only a short time ago, and they have only been employed by me within the last few years. Your ignorance on the subject, therefore, is easily accounted for. However, you will be better informed as to me and my possessions ere long." And the Count, while pronouncing these latter words, accompanied them with one of those ghastly smiles that used to strike terror into poor France d'Epernay.
"With your tastes and means of gratifying them," continued Danglars, "you will exhibit a splendour that must effectually put us poor miserable millionaires quite in the background. If perfectly agreeable to you, I shall do myself the honour of introducing you to Madame la Baronne Danglars. Excuse my impatience, Monsieur le Comte, but a person of your wealth and influence cannot receive too much attention."
Monte Cristo bowed, in sign that he accepted the proffered honour, and the financier immediately rang a small bell, which was answered by a servant in a showy livery.
"Is Madame la Baronne at home?" inquired Danglars.
"Yes, Monsieur le Baron," answered the man.
"And alone?"
"No, Monsieur le Baron. Madame has visitors.
Have you any objection to meet any persons who may be with Madame, or do you desire to preserve a strict incognito? No, indeed, replied Monte Cristo with a smile. I do not arrogate to myself the right of so doing. And who is with Madame? Monsieur Debray? Inquired Danglars, with an air of indulgence and good nature that made Monte Cristo smile, acquainted as he was with the secrets of the banker's domestic life. Yes, Monsieur le Baron, replied the servant. Monsieur Debray is with Madame. Danglars nodded his head, then turning to Monte Cristo said, Monsieur Lucien Debray is an old friend of ours, and private secretary to the Ministre de l'Intérieur. As for my wife, I must tell you, she lowered herself by marrying me, for she belongs to one of the most ancient families in France. Her maiden name was de Servière, and her first husband was Monsieur le Colonel Marquis de Nargonne.
I have not the honour of knowing Madame Danglars, but I have already met Monsieur Lucien Debray.
Ah, indeed, said Danglars. And where was that?
At the house of Monsieur de Morcerf.
Oh, what, you are acquainted with the young Viscount, are you?
We were together a good deal during the carnival at Rome.
True, true, cried Danglars. Let me see. Have I not heard talk of some strange adventure with bandits or thieves hid in ruins, and of his having had a miraculous escape? I forget how, but I know he used to amuse my wife and daughter by telling them about it after his return from Italy.
Madame la Baronne is waiting to receive you, gentlemen, said the servant, who had gone to inquire the pleasure of his mistress.
With your permission, said Danglars, bowing, I will precede you to show you the way.
By all means, replied Monte Cristo. I follow you. 48. The Dappled Greys. The Baron, followed by the Count, traversed a long suite of apartments in which the prevailing characteristics were heavy magnificence and the gaudiness of ostentatious wealth, until he reached the boudoir of Madame Danglars, a small octagonal-shaped room hung with pink satin covered with white Indian muslin. The chairs were of ancient workmanship and materials. Over the doors were painted sketches of shepherds and shepherdesses after the style and manner of Boucher, and at each side pretty medallions in crayons, harmonizing well with the fittings up of this charming apartment, the only one throughout the vast mansion in which any distinctive taste prevailed. The truth was, it had been entirely overlooked in the plan arranged and followed out by Monsieur Danglars and his architect, who had been selected to aid the Baron in the great work of improvement he meditated solely because he was the most fashionable and celebrated decorator of the day. The ornamental part of the fittings-up of Madame Danglars' boudoir had then been left entirely to herself and Lucien Debray. Monsieur Danglars, however, while possessing a great admiration for the antique, as it was understood during the time of the Directory, entertained the most sovereign contempt for the simple elegance of his wife's favourite sitting-room, where, by the way, he was never permitted to intrude unless, indeed, he excused his own appearance by ushering in some more agreeable visitor than himself. And even then, he had rather the air and manner of a person who was himself introduced than as being the presenter of another, his reception being either cordial or frigid, in proportion as the individual who accompanied him chanced to please or displease his lady wife. As Danglars now entered, he found Madame la Baronne, who, although past the first bloom of youth, was still strikingly handsome, seated at the piano, a most elaborate piece of cabinet and inlaid work, while Lucien Debray, standing before a small work-table, was turning over the pages of an album. Lucien had found time, preparatory to the Count's arrival, to relate many particulars respecting him to Madame Danglars. It will be remembered that Monte Cristo had made a lively impression on the minds of all the party assembled at the breakfast given by Albert de Morcerf, and although Debray was not in the habit of yielding to such feelings, he had never been able to shake off the powerful influence excited in his mind by the impressive look and manner of the Count. Consequently, the description given by Lucien to the Baroness bore the highly coloured tinge of his own heated imagination. Already excited by the wonderful stories related of the Count by de Morcerf, it is no wonder that Madame Danglars eagerly listened to and fully credited all the additional circumstances detailed by Debray. The sound of approaching footsteps compelled the animated pair to assume an appearance of calm indifference and worldly ease. The lady flew to her piano, and her companion snatched up an album, which fortunately lay near, and seemed as though really interested in its contents. A most gracious welcome and unusual smile were bestowed on Monsieur Danglars. The Count, in return for his gentlemanly bow, received a formal, though graceful, curtsy, while Lucien exchanged with the Count a sort of distant recognition, and with Danglars a free and easy nod.
"Baroness," said Danglars, "give me leave to present to you the Count of Monte Cristo, who has been most warmly recommended to me by my correspondents at Rome. I need not mention one fact to make all the ladies in Paris court his notice, and that is that the noble individual before you has come to take up his abode in our fine capital for 1 year, during which brief period he proposes to spend 6 millions of money. Think of that. It sounds very much like an announcement of balls, fêtes, dinners, and picnic parties, in all of which I trust Monsieur Le Comte will remember us, as he may depend upon it we shall remember him in all the entertainments we may give, be they great or small."
In spite of the gross flattery and coarseness of this address, Madame Danglars could not forbear gazing with considerable interest on a man capable of expending 6 millions in 12 months, and who had selected Paris for the scene of his princely extravagance.
"And when did you arrive here?" inquired she.
"Yesterday morning, madame. Coming as usual, I presume, from the extreme end of the globe. Pardon me, at least such I have heard is your custom.
Nay, madame, this time I have merely proceeded from Cadiz hither." "You have selected a most unfavourable moment for your first visit to our city. Paris is a horrible place in summer. Balls, parties, and fêtes are over. The Italian opera is in London, the French opera everywhere except at Paris. As for the Théâtre Français, you know, of course, that it is nowhere. The only amusement left us are the indifferent races held in the Champ de Mars and Satory. Do you propose entering any horses at either of these races, Monsieur Le Comte?"
"I assure you, madame," replied Monte Cristo, "my present intentions are to do whatever will tend to render my sojourn in Paris most agreeable to myself and others. I only pray I may find some kind, pitying friend who will commiserate my lamentable ignorance of such matters and instruct me rightly to understand the habits and etiquette of this polished city."
"Are you fond of horses, Monsieur Le Comte?"
"I have passed a considerable part of my life in the East, madame. And you are doubtless aware that the inhabitants of those climes value only two things, the fine breeding of their horses and the beauty of their females."
"Nay, Monsieur Le Comte," said the Baroness, "it would have been somewhat more gallant to have placed the ladies before the animals.
You see, madame, how rightly I spoke when I said I required a preceptor to guide me in all my sayings and doings here." At this instant, the favourite attendant of Madame Danglars entered the boudoir. Approaching her mistress, she spoke some words in an undertone. Madame Danglars turned very pale, then exclaimed,
"I cannot believe it. The thing is impossible." "I assure you, madame," replied the woman, "it is even as I have said."
Turning impatiently towards her husband, Madame Danglars demanded,
"Is this true?" "Is what true, madame?" inquired Danglars, visibly agitated. "That when my coachman was about to prepare my carriage, he discovered that the horses had been removed from the stables without his knowledge? I desire to know what is the meaning of this."
"Be kind enough, madame, to listen to me," said Danglars.
"Fear not my listening, aye, and attentively, too. For in truth I am most curious to hear what explanation you purpose offering for conduct so unparalleled. These two gentlemen shall decide between us, but first I will state the case to them."
"Gentlemen," continued the Baroness, "among the 10 horses in the stables of Monsieur le Baron Danglars are 2 that belong exclusively to me.
a pair of the handsomest and most spirited creatures to be found in Paris. But to you at least, Monsieur Debray, I need not give a further description, because to you my beautiful pair of dappled greys were well known. Well, I had promised Madame de Villefort the loan of my carriage to drive tomorrow to the Bois de Boulogne. But when my coachman goes to fetch the greys from the stables, they are gone, positively gone. No doubt Monsieur Danglars has sacrificed them to the selfish consideration of gaining some thousands of paltry francs. Oh, how I hate and detest that money-grasping nature! Heaven defend me from all the race of mercenary speculators! Madame, replied Danglars, the horses were not sufficiently quiet for you. They were scarcely 4 years old, and they made me extremely uneasy on your account. Nonsense, retorted the Baroness. You could not have entertained any alarm on the subject, because you are perfectly well aware that I have recently engaged a coachman who is said to be the best in Paris. But perhaps you have disposed of the coachman as well as the horses, my dear love. Pray do not say any more about them, and I promise you another pair exactly like them in appearance, only more quiet and steady. The Baroness shrugged up her shoulders with an air of ineffable contempt, while her husband, affecting not to observe it, turned towards Monte Cristo and said, "Upon my word, Monsieur Le Comte, I am quite sorry I was not sooner aware of your establishing yourself in Paris." "And wherefore?" asked the Count. "Because I should have liked to have made you the offer of these horses. I have almost given them away as it is, but as I before said, I was anxious to get rid of them upon any terms. They were only fit for a young man, not at all calculated for a person at my time of life."
"I am much obliged by your kind intentions towards me," said Monte Cristo, "but this morning I purchased a very excellent pair of carriage horses, and I do not think they were dear. There they are. Come, Monsieur Debray, you are a connoisseur, I believe. Let me have your opinion upon them." As Debray walked towards the window, Danglars approached his wife.
"I could not tell you before others," said he, in a low tone, "the reason of my parting with the horses, but a most enormous price was offered me this morning for them. Some madman or fool, bent upon ruining himself as fast as he can, actually sent his steward to me to purchase them at any cost. And the fact is, I have gained 16,000 francs by the sale of them. Come, don't look so angry, and you shall have 4,000 francs of the money to do what you like with, and Eugenie shall have 2,000. There, what do you think now of the affair? Wasn't I right to part with the horses?"
Madame Danglars surveyed her husband with a look of withering contempt.
"What do I see?"
suddenly exclaimed Debray.
"Where?" asked the Baroness. "I cannot be mistaken. There are your horses, the very animals we were speaking of, harnessed to the Count's carriage." "My dear, beautiful, dappled greys?" demanded the Baroness, springing to the window. "'Tis indeed they," said she.
Danglars looked absolutely stultified.
"How very singular," cried Monte Cristo, with well-feigned astonishment.
Madame Danglars whispered a few words in the ear of Debray, who approached Monte Cristo, saying,
"The Baroness wishes to know what you paid her husband for the horses."
"I scarcely know," replied the Count. "It was a little surprise prepared for me by my steward. He knew how desirous I was of meeting with precisely such a pair of horses, and so he bought them. I think, if I remember rightly, he hinted that he had given somewhere about 30,000 francs.
Debray conveyed the Count's reply to the Baroness. Poor Danglars looked so crestfallen and discomfited that Monte Cristo assumed a pitying air towards him.
"See," said the Count, "how very ungrateful women are. Your kind attention in providing for the safety of the Baroness by disposing of the horses does not seem to have made the least impression on her. But so it is. A woman will often, from mere wilfulness, prefer that which is dangerous to that which is safe. Therefore, in my opinion, my dear Baron, the best and easiest way is to leave them to their fancies, and allow them to act as they please, and then, if any mischief follows, why, at least they have no one to blame but themselves."
Danglars made no reply. He was occupied in anticipations of the coming scene between himself and the Baroness, whose threatening looks and frowning brow, like that of Olympic Jove, predicted a fearful storm. Debray, who perceived the gathering clouds and felt no desire to witness the explosion of Madame Danglars' rage, suddenly recollected an appointment which compelled him to take his leave, while Monte Cristo, unwilling to destroy the advantages he hoped to obtain by prolonging his stay, made a farewell bow and departed, leaving Danglars to endure the angry reproaches of his wife. "Excellent," murmured Monte Cristo to himself as he retraced the way to his carriage. "All has gone according to my wishes. The domestic peace of this family is henceforth in my hands. Now then, to play another master stroke, by which I shall gain the heart of both husband and wife. Delightful. Still," added he, "amid all this, I have not yet been presented to Mademoiselle Eugénie Danglars, whose acquaintance I should have been glad to make. But never mind," pursued he, with that peculiar smile that at times lighted up his countenance, "it matters not for the present. I am on the spot and have plenty of time before me. By and by will do for that part of my scheme." The Count's further meditations were interrupted by his arrival at his own abode. 2 hours afterwards, Madame Danglars received a most flattering epistle from the Count, in which he entreated her to receive back her favourite dappled greys, protesting that he could not endure the idea of making his debut in the Parisian world of fashion with the knowledge that his splendid equipage had been obtained at the price of a lovely woman's regrets. The horses were sent back, wearing the same harness they had done in the morning. The only difference consisted in the rosettes worn on the heads of the animals being adorned with a large diamond placed in the centre of each by order of the Count. To Danglars, Monte Cristo also wrote, requesting him to excuse the whimsical gift of a capricious millionaire, and to beg of Madame la Baronne to pardon the Eastern fashion adopted in the return of the horses. During the evening, Monte Cristo quitted Paris for Auteuil, accompanied by Ali. The following day, about 3 o'clock, a single blow struck on the gong summoned Ali to the presence of the Count. "Ali," observed his master as the Nubian entered the chamber, "you have frequently explained to me how more than commonly skilful you are in throwing the lasso, have you not?" Ali drew himself up proudly, and then returned a sign in the affirmative. "I thought I did not mistake. With your lasso you could stop an ox?" Again, Ali repeated his affirmative gesture. "Or a tiger?" Ali bowed his head in token of assent. "A lion, even." Ali sprung forwards, imitating the action of one throwing the lasso, then of a strangled lion. "I understand," said Monte Cristo. "You wish to tell me you have hunted the lion?" Ali smiled with triumphant pride as he signified that he had indeed both chased and captured many lions. "But do you believe you could arrest the progress of 2 horses rushing forwards with ungovernable fury?" The Nubian smiled. "It is well," said Monte Cristo. "Then listen to me. Ere long a carriage will dash past here drawn by the pair of dappled grey horses you saw me with yesterday. Now, at the risk of your own life, you must manage to stop those horses before my door." Ali descended to the street and marked a straight line on the pavement immediately at the entrance of the house, and then pointed out the line he had traced to the Count, who was watching him. The Count patted him gently on the back, his usual mode of praising Ali, who, pleased and gratified with the commission assigned him, walked calmly towards a projecting stone forming the angle of the street and house, and, seating himself thereon, began to smoke his chibouk, while Monte Cristo re-entered his dwelling, perfectly assured of the success of his plan. Still, as 5 o'clock approached and the carriage was momentarily expected by the Count, the indication of more than common impatience and uneasiness might be observed in his manner. He stationed himself in a room commanding a view of the street, pacing the chamber with restless steps, stopping merely to listen from time to time for the sound of approaching wheels, then to cast an anxious glance on Ali. But the regularity with which the Nubian puffed forth the smoke of his chibouk proved that he, at least, was wholly absorbed in the enjoyment of his favourite occupation. Suddenly, a distant sound of rapidly advancing wheels was heard, and almost immediately a carriage appeared, drawn by a pair of wild, ungovernable horses, who rushed forward as though urged by the fiend himself, while the terrified coachman strove in vain to restrain their furious speed. In the vehicle was a female, apparently young, and a child of about 7 or 8 years of age. Terror seemed to have deprived them even of the power of uttering a cry, and both were clasped in each other's arms, as though determined not to be parted by death itself. The carriage creaked and rattled as it flew over the rough stones, and had it encountered the slightest impediment to its progress, it must inevitably have upset, but it still flew on, and the cries of the affrighted spectators testified the universal sense of the imminent peril its occupants were threatened with. Then Ali knew the right moment was come, and throwing down his chibouk, he drew the lasso from his pocket, threw it so skilfully as to catch the forelegs of the near horse in its triple fold, suffered himself to be dragged on for a few steps, by which time the tightening of the well-cast lasso had so completely hampered the furious animal as to bring it to the ground, and falling on the pole, it snapped, and therefore prevented the other animal from pursuing its headlong way. Gladly availing himself of this opportunity, the coachman leaped from his box, but Ali had promptly seized the nostrils of the second horse and held them in his iron grasp, till the maddened beast, snorting with pain, sunk beside his companion. All this was achieved in much less time than is occupied in the recital. The brief space had, however, been sufficient for an individual, followed by a number of servants, to rush from the house before which the accident had occurred, and, as the coachman opened the door of the carriage, to take from it a lady who was convulsively grasping the cushions with one hand, while with the other she pressed to her bosom her young companion, who had lost all consciousness of what was passing. Monte Cristo carried them both to the salon, and deposited them on a sofa. "Compose yourself, madame," said he. "All danger is over." The female looked up at these words, and, with a glance far more expressive than any entreaties could have been, pointed to her child, who still continued insensible. "I understand the nature of your alarms, madame," said the count, carefully examining the child, "but I assure you there is not the slightest occasion for uneasiness. Your little charge has not received the least injury. His insensibility is merely the effects of terror, and will soon cease." "Are you quite sure you do not say so to tranquillize my fears? See how deadly pale he is. My child, my darling Edouard, speak to your mother. Open your dear eyes and look on me once again. Oh, sir, in pity, send for help. My whole fortune shall not be thought too much for the recovery of my blessed boy." With a calm smile and gentle wave of the hand, Monte Cristo signed to the distracted mother to lay aside her apprehensions. Then, opening a casket that stood near, he drew forth a phial composed of Bohemian glass, containing a liquid of the colour of blood, of which he let fall a single drop on the child's lips. Scarcely had it reached them, ere the boy, though still pale as marble, opened his eyes and eagerly gazed around him. At this unhoped-for sight, the wild delight of the mother equalled her former despair. "Where am I?" exclaimed she, when her first raptures at her son's recovery were past. "And to whom am I indebted for so happy a termination to my late dreadful alarm?" "Madame," answered the count, "you are under the roof of one who esteems himself most fortunate in having been able to save you from a further continuance of your sufferings." "My wretched curiosity has brought all this about," pursued the lady. "All Paris rung with the praises of Madame Danglars' beautiful horses, and I had the folly to desire to know whether they really merited the high character given of them." "Is it possible," exclaimed the count with well-feigned astonishment, "that these horses belong to Madame la Baronne?" "They do indeed. May I inquire if you are acquainted with Madame Danglars? I have that honour, and my happiness at your escape from the danger that threatened you is redoubled by the consciousness that I have been the unwilling and unintentional cause of all the peril you have incurred. I yesterday purchased these horses of the Baron, but as the Baroness evidently regretted parting with them, I ventured to send them back to her, with a request that she would gratify me by accepting them from my hands." "You are, then, doubtless, the Count of Monte Cristo, of whom Hermine has talked to me so much?"
"You have rightly guessed, madame," replied the count.
"And I am Madame Eloise de Villefort."
The count bowed with the air of a person who hears a name for the first time.
How grateful will Monsieur de Villefort be for all your goodness! How thankfully will he acknowledge that to you alone it is owing that his wife and child exist! Most certainly, but for the prompt assistance of your intrepid servant, this dear child and myself must both have perished. Indeed, I still shudder at the recollection of the fearful danger you were placed in, as well as your interesting child. I trust you will not object to my offering a recompense to your noble-hearted servant, proportionate to the service he has rendered me and mine. I beseech you, madame, replied Monte Cristo, not to spoil Ali, either by too great praise or rewards. I cannot allow him to acquire the habit of expecting to be recompensed for every trifling service he may render. Ali is my slave, and in saving your life he was but discharging his duty to me.
Nay, interposed Madame de Villefort, on whom the authoritative style adopted by the Count made a deep impression. Nay, but consider that to preserve my life he has risked his own. His life, Madame, belongs not to him. It is mine, in return for my having myself saved him from death. Madame de Villefort made no further reply. Her mind was utterly absorbed in the contemplation of the singular individual who, from the first instant of her beholding him, had made so powerful an impression on her. During the evident preoccupation of Madame de Villefort, Monte Cristo scrutinized the features and appearance of the boy she kept folded in her arms, lavishing on him the most tender endearments. The child was small for his age and unnaturally pale. A mass of straight black hair, defying all attempts to train or curl it, fell over his projecting forehead and hung down to his shoulders, giving increased vivacity to eyes already sparkling with a youthful love of mischief and fondness for every forbidden enjoyment. His mouth was large, and the lips, which had not yet regained their colour, were particularly thin. In fact, the deep and crafty look forming the principal character of the child's face belonged rather to a boy of 12 or 14 years of age than to one so young. His first movement was to free himself by a violent push from the encircling arms of his mother, and to rush forwards to the casket from whence the Count had taken the phial of elixir. Then, without asking permission of anyone, he proceeded in all the wilfulness of a spoiled child, unaccustomed to restrain either whims or caprices, to pull the corks out of all the bottles in the casket. "Touch nothing, my little friend," cried the Count eagerly. "Some of those liquids are not only dangerous to taste, but even to smell." Madame de Villefort became very pale, and seizing her son's arm, drew him anxiously towards her. But once satisfied of his safety, she also cast a brief but expressive glance on the casket, which was not lost upon the Count. At this moment, Ali entered. At sight of him, Madame de Villefort uttered an expression of pleasure, and holding the child still closer towards her, she said, "Edouard, dearest, do you see that good man? He has shown very great courage and resolution, for he exposed his own life to stop the horses that were running away with us, and would certainly have dashed the carriage to pieces ere long. Thank him, then, my child, in your very best manner, for had he not come to our aid, neither you nor I would have been alive to speak our thanks." This address, however, excited no similar feeling of gratitude on the part of the child, who, instead of obeying his mother's directions, stuck out his lips and turned away his head in a disdainful and contemptuous manner, saying, "I don't like him. He's too ugly for me." The Count witnessed all this with internal satisfaction, and a smile stole over his features as he thought that such a child bade fair to realize one part of his hopes, while Madame de Villefort reprimanded her son with a gentleness and moderation very far from conveying the least idea of a fault having been committed. "This lady," said the Count, speaking to Ali in the Arabic language, "is desirous that her son should thank you for saving both their lives, but the boy refuses, saying, 'You are too ugly.'" Ali turned his intelligent countenance towards the boy, on whom he gazed without any apparent emotion, but the sort of spasmodic working of the nostrils showed to the practiced eye of Monte Cristo how deeply the Arab was wounded by the unfeeling remark. "Will you permit me to inquire," said Madame de Villefort, as she rose to take her leave, "whether you usually reside here?" "No, I do not,"
replied Monte Cristo. It is a small place I have purchased quite lately. My place of abode is number 30 Avenue de Champs-Élysées, but I am delighted to see your countenance seems expressive of a perfect return to tranquillity. You have quite recovered from your fright and are, no doubt, desirous of returning home. Anticipating your wishes, I have desired the same horses you came with to be put to one of my carriages, and Ali, he whom you think so very ugly, continued he, addressing the boy with a smiling air, will have the honour of driving you home, while your coachman remains here to attend to the necessary repairs of your calèche. Directly that important business is concluded, I will have a couple of my own horses harnessed to convey it directly to Madame Danglars.
I dare not return with those dreadful horses, said Madame de Villefort.
You will see, replied Monte Cristo, that they will be as different as possible in the hands of Ali. With him they will be gentle and docile as lambs. Ali had indeed given proof of this, for approaching the animals, who had been got upon their legs with considerable difficulty, he rubbed their foreheads and nostrils with a sponge soaked in aromatic vinegar, and wiped off the sweat and foam that covered their mouths. Then, commencing a loud whistling noise, he rubbed them well all over their bodies for several minutes, and, undisturbed by the noisy crowd collected round the broken carriage, Ali quietly harnessed the pacified animals to the Count's chariot, took the reins in his hands, and mounted the box, when, lo, to the utter astonishment of those who had witnessed the ungovernable spirit and maddened velocity of the same horses, he was actually compelled to apply his whip, in no very gentle manner, ere he could induce them to start, and even then all that could be obtained from the celebrated dappled greys, now changed into a couple of as dull, sluggish, stupid brutes as the most timid driver would desire to meet with, was a slow, pottering pace, kept up with so much difficulty that Madame de Villefort was more than a couple of hours returning to her residence in the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. Scarcely had the first congratulations upon her miraculous escape been gone through than she retired to her room, ostensibly for the purpose of seeking a little repose, but in reality to write the following letter to Madame Danglars.
Dear Hermine, I have just had a wonderful escape from the most imminent danger, and I owe my safety to the very Count of Monte Cristo we were talking about yesterday, but whom I little expected to see today. I remember how unmercifully I laughed at what I considered your eulogistic and exaggerated praises of him, but I have now ample cause to admit that your enthusiastic description of this wonderful man fell far short of his merits. But I must endeavour to render the account of my adventures somewhat more intelligible. You must know, then, my dear friend, that when I had proceeded with your horses as far as Ranelagh, they darted forwards like mad things, and galloped away at so fearful a rate that there seemed no other prospect for myself and my poor Edouard but that of being dashed to pieces against the first object that impeded their progress, when a strange-looking man, an Arab or a Nubian, at least a black of some nation or other, at a signal from the Count, whose domestic he is, suddenly seized and stopped the infuriated animals, even at the risk of being trampled to death himself. And certainly he must have had a most wonderful escape. The Count then hastened to us and carried myself and son into his house, where, by some skilful application, he speedily recalled my poor Edouard, who was quite insensible from terror, to life. When we were sufficiently recovered, he sent us home in his own carriage. Yours will be returned to you tomorrow. I am fearful you will not be able to use your horses for some days. They seem thoroughly stupefied, as if sulky and vexed at having allowed this black servant to conquer them after all. The Count, however, has commissioned me to assure you that 2 or 3 days' rest, with plenty of barley for their sole food during that time, will bring them back to their former fine condition, which means, I suppose, that they will be ready to run off with the carriage again and play their wild pranks with as much headstrong fury as they evinced yesterday. Do not let them endanger your life, dear Hermine, as they did mine, for Providence may not send a Monte Cristo or his Nubian servant to preserve you from destruction as it did me. Adieu.
I cannot return you many thanks for the drive of yesterday, but after all I ought not to blame you for the misconduct of your horses, more especially as it procured me the pleasure of an introduction to the Count of Monte Cristo, and certainly that illustrious individual, apart from the millions he is said to be so very anxious to dispose of, seemed to me one of those curiously interesting problems which I, for one, delight in solving at any risk or danger. Nay, so bent am I on following up my acquaintance with this remarkable personage, that if all other means fail, I really believe I shall have to borrow your horses again and make another excursion to the Bois de Boulogne. My sweet Edouard endured the accident with admirable courage. He did not utter a single cry, but fell lifeless into my arms, nor did a tear fall from his eyes after it was over. I doubt not you will consider these praises the result of blind maternal affection, but the delicate, fragile form of my beloved child contains a mind of no ordinary strength, with the heroic firmness of a Spartan boy. Valentine sends